Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Marco Nunziata, thought leader on economics, innovation and digital industry. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, the economy and policy, and reframing how we innovate and build for the future. In this podcast series, we are exploring these new ecosystemic impacts across every facet of society, from the future of education, work, agriculture, engineering, tech, aviation, and space, to name just a few. And today we will be discussing values-based optimization and how this can be a powerful framework for supporting ecosystemic wellness. But before we jump in, I'm thrilled to be joined by my co-host, James Villarubia, and I'll pass the mic quickly to James to introduce himself. James.
Thanks, Marco. Hello, everyone. I'm your co-host, James Villarubia. I'm currently a White House Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, and I started my career doing optimization for the public sector for sort of large government agencies, so I'm actually really excited to dig into this topic. So over to you, Marco.
Thank you, James. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our guest, Ed Powell, whom you will also hear join us as a co-host on other episodes. Ed and I love challenging each other, so I'm thrilled to have him as a guest today. And today will be an especially interesting episode. So we're talking about values-based optimization. Ed, can you give us an overview of values-based optimization so that we are all thinking about this from the same context?
Sure. And it's great to be here. So this journey began for me in the mid-90s when I was studying the applications of AI to space warfare. And I kind of came to this epiphany that model-based reasoning could handle more complexity and more uncertainty at the same time than rule-based systems. And at that time, almost all expert systems were rule-based. If then, case statements, those kinds of things that were really focused on programmers, not on the end users, not on those who were making policies or those who were making operational decisions. And so the epiphany for us was that if you could model space systems at the time as microeconomic entities that had resources to deploy, in that case, cryogen, power, thermal capacity, et cetera, and requirements they were trying to meet, that they were observing certain complexes in certain configurations and geometries, then you could drive the net economic value of those assets over their life. And to us, that was a significant, you know, uptake. The other thing about that was we realized by running simulations that you could actually cut the cost of operations in those systems by 20%, and you could drive a whole set of missions that people had never considered before. And so that began for us a journey of applying these ideas of model-based artificial intelligence and optimizing complex systems in supply chains, services, intellectual property, insurance, and healthcare.
That's a great introduction and a fascinating introduction, Ed. So we're talking about models that help us deal with trade-offs. And trade-offs, especially in economics, they are part of our trade, our bread and butter. So let me start with this. In this kind of modeling, what is the best way of optimizing the trade-off between, for example, price and performance, so things that are not immediately comparable? What is the approach?
So the approach is to go through a structured process of helping decision makers understand the contributions of various components of these complex systems to their overall mission. And then being able to say, what is a certain amount of one thing worth compared to a certain amount of another? And I'll give you an example. So recently, we have a platform that looks across the education environment, higher education, and we're looking at things like enrollment. And so the question comes up for the head of enrollment, what are your key performance indicators? And they say, well, we care about our U.S. News and World Report rank. We care about tuition revenue. We care about the quality of the students. We care about the demographic mix of the population of the incoming class. And so they said, so we really don't need any help. And my response to that was, that's great. So how much revenue are you willing to give up in order to get another point of ACT? And that's like, oh, we've never thought about that. And so those are the very questions we tend to dig into to figure out how much are you willing to give up of one thing in order to get something else, and then to have an overall kind of operational performance model that drives outcomes that you can measure against each other to decide which scenario would be a better scenario for the organization.
It's a great example because it shows that sometimes we don't even realize there is a trade-off.
The primary thing we find when we go in is we begin to ask those questions that people haven't really considered. In fact, in this case, this is a very accomplished academician who, in almost an act of charity in his mind, had become the head of enrollment. Very, very sophisticated data analysis kind of background. And so he was thinking, you know, I'm just a lot brighter than all the people who do these kinds of things. And then when he started asking those questions, he just, those are actually quite good questions because no one's thinking that way.
So to sort of put that in maybe a different context, I think it's easy for, you know, our audience and our listeners to sort of consider price and performance. It might look a little different, you know, not in the private sector, but in the public sector. When we start talking about performance of government institutions, things maybe get a little squishier where you have to spend all the dollars, where you're providing a service, not necessarily for profit. How does sort of this framework of value-based optimizations fit into our current model of government in the US? And how, you know, how has it informed policies in the past or sort of maybe moving forward? So, you know, help us sort of connect the dots there.
Well, that's a great question. So we always think about the world in terms of being able to have three things, right? Time, cost, and quality. And typically you can fix two. So you can fix time and cost and you work to have really bad quality. So when we think about like a government entity, we're thinking about a set again of mission objectives. So for example, we're doing work with the Space Force. And the question is, if you're designing the next, say, tranche two layer of the Space Development Agency's satellite network, you have issues of trade-offs between communications and sensors, between field of view and precision and a resolution of sensors. All those kinds of things come in, and you again tie those back into the overall mission objectives. You care about custody, what kinds of things do you care about, and then how do you make those trade-offs even with a fixed budget? What we also find is interesting about that is by using this, once you have this model and this value-based approach, if the general comes and says, if we gave you $100 million more, where would you spend it and what would we get for it? And this platform allows those decision makers to know exactly where they should spend it and exactly from a mission objective perspective, what the general is going to get. And we just think that's a game changer, especially in a highly dynamic world where you have adversaries, you have other constraints, you have all things going on, and you're trying to figure out how to ultimately optimize limited resources against a whole set of threats and opportunities.
And it's fantastic because what you just highlighted that is the power of this model in helping us keep track of a lot of moving parts and maintaining this multi-factor optimization as circumstances change. But James' point, I think, is also very important because mentioning government also brings us to the issue of different values, which are often hard to trade off against each other, at least intuitively. So in models like this, how do you deal with human elements like wellness or employees' needs and well-being, to stay in a corporate example, and trading them off about against things like productivity, which are measurable in a more standard and physical and monetary way?
Those are great questions. So when people are typically looking at optimizing systems, a lot of the companies we even interact with, they'll begin by saying, well, we want to just minimize cost. And then once we minimize cost, we try to go do something else. Like, for example, we're in servicing certain things. And while the technician is in providing the service, he or she can also upsell other things. So what we do is we minimize the cost of deploying the resources. And then we go and try to figure out how to allocate the, you know, sales opportunities amongst these people. Our approach is to say, no, what you should do is actually optimize across the board. You include the sales component in the optimization of the efficiency. So when you're looking at it, you're kind of jointly optimizing all these factors in one place. What becomes really important is as we look at these, we think about the people. And we ask the question, okay, if I were a technician and I were servicing this, And at the end of the day, son was playing soccer at this location. Wouldn't I want my route to end up over there near that soccer game? And so we always bring these things to customers. Like, these are ways that you can actually provide benefits to your employees that will drive like employee loyalty and satisfaction without actually harming you, because we're gonna optimize the route, including these intangibles. All right. So one of the things we've done recently is we looked at, a lot of the ESG funds are going to the Department of Justice and asking for antitrust waivers. Like, we're doing all this good. We think you should allow us to, you know, basically relax some of the antitrust, restrictions. And so we recently did a big analysis where we looked at a large retailer and all the distribution business of that retailer, because you have front-end kind of market concentration, you have back-end delivery concentration. It's huge, potentially antitrust issues. And so we looked at it and said, well, what would be the cost if you broke up that back-end distribution business in terms of carbon footprint, in terms of employee harm, like wrecks and hospitalizations and deaths, and even direct variable costs, fuel consumption, et cetera. And those are all things that are part of this trade-off. Now, antitrust can be more important, but at least this way, we for the first time are actually putting hard dollar costs and intangibles costs, casualty risk, to the question of reducing the concentration of and the density of delivery.
So to sort of maybe click in on that a little bit more, if you're talking about sort of dealing with, I love the example of incorporating employee satisfaction and sort of finding these sort of maybe traditionally out of scope metrics and values to incorporate in your optimization and how that creates win-wins. But I guess I've sort of seen the darker side of optimization of sort of black box AIs, particularly now that AI is getting much more complicated. What do you see as the dangers of maybe taking this too far? Or how do we prevent our, companies and teams and groups from taking, leaders from taking this too far and, taking that sort of black box AI and optimization well beyond maybe it was intended scope and, leading to sort of unintended consequences that might be negative for employees? How do we sort of prevent that?
Well, okay, that's a great question. And as you know from our work together on CAS, I always look at systems to figure out how could this go wrong, right? How might this be misused, or how might this somehow not end up well?
And so many ways, right?
There are so many ways. That's right. And so when we look at these questions, one of the first things we thought about was, well, artificial neural networks are really topologies and data. And so we created a framework using a combination of what we call the network sensitivity analysis and game theory, using a thing called Shapley and Nash, to be able to determine the relative contribution of various data sets in the training of the artificial neural network. And then if you go and look for, okay, how did this result happen? We can go look at the data sets. And if there are certain biases in those data sets that are used to train the neural network, well, then that could be very interesting. Like, for example, in certain clinical trials, they didn't have pregnant women included. And then all of a sudden, birth defects and things that come out of that, well, they happened because they didn't include that demographic in that study. There are all kinds of ways that neural networks could be biased and provide, a set of predictions, but those predictions are really based on a set of biased inputs. And so those are the kinds of things that we look at. We are huge believers and have had a lot of focus for us in explainability of all of our systems. If you want operational adoption of what you do, you have to be able to explain to the underwriters or to the operations people why it is that the system did what it did. And it gets back to this question Marco asked earlier. So we, for example, were optimizing the deployment of resources for a company called Dell. And so at times there would be like a customer location where the power supply was being replaced by a lower cost resource, and then the network was being all set up by a higher cost resource. And rather than do that, Dell said, well, we know that it's a lower cost solution, but we would prefer to not appear to be suboptimal in how we send our people. So we'd rather just send one person and have the higher priced resource actually swap out the power supply, even if it's a lower cost to send to. And so we just had another factor added in the model that said the value of not appearing suboptimal. And so it would actually allow a certain level of trade-off in that, so that the system would actually say, don't send two resources because it's going to cost you more, because that's a valuable thing to Dell, an intangible, but a valuable thing to Dell, that they not appear suboptimal.
So to quickly follow up on that, it sounds like, at least with regards to the black box and AI, that it still comes with all of the sort of the struggle that people might throw in AI. You know, I think there's a joke that AI is just statistics at scale, or statistics really fast. It sounds like even within this framework, there are still going to be issues around sort of overfitting or assumptions of linearity that you have to sort of have to get around. So there's a lot of power here to maybe sort of reframe your metrics to be more inclusive and yield maybe sort of more nuanced results. But that requires some skill to do correctly, because you can sort of, you know, use this tool to beat a number into submission and maybe not get the results that are actually, you know, true to the reality. Is that fair?
No, it's fair that everything that neural networks do, that you have to understand the nuance of them, and you have to understand kind of what's predictive versus what's just correlated. I mean, for example, we processed 40 billion payer claims. So every payer claim in the U.S. for 5 years, for every physician in the U.S. And we use that as almost like a set of time cards for physicians, what procedures they were doing, what drugs they prescribed, what everything. And what was really powerful about our approach to using the network sensitivity analysis was we could show underwriters when you prescribed a drug, how that was impacting the likelihood you were sued for malpractice. We could also look at practice patterns, and we found a lot of things. Things like, what percentage of your procedure claims were surgery? The people who all they did was surgery had actually, that was the lowest contribution cohort of that surgical percentage to the overall risk. The people who did no surgery didn't really change it. The people who were between like 30 and 70% surgery, bad idea. Like you don't want to carry a surgeon's risk without a surgeon's skill. And if you're going to do it, you just want to do surgery all day long, because that's really that specialization. This is back to Marco. The specialization is really critical. You want to go have your knee replaced by the guy who does 1,000 of those a year, not 10. All right.
So note to the audience, no part-time surgeons.
No part-time surgeons.
That is, yes, it's a big takeaway.
Right. And we also looked at it as things like work RVU, which is a measure of the intensity. And it turned out that if you had a broad range of things, your risk was much higher. And so these are the kinds of things that we had to have for the underwriters to be able to actually believe the model. Because if you don't have that kind of explainability of the model, then you just won't get adoption of the black box. And it's just not satisfying either, because we like to know, why is it telling me that this person is in danger of a certain thing? If I'm not able to see the causal effect, I kind of don't believe it. And by the way, one other thing on that. It's critical that it do two things. One, that it show you what you know, and then two, it show you things that you wouldn't have predicted. The showing what you know gives you confidence to trust it. To show you what you wouldn't have predicted gives you confidence to believe it can show you things that you're not going to get.
Exactly. Yeah, that aha moment can be powerful. Yeah.
Very powerful.
Great.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's something else you brought up, Ed, in this discussion, which is the importance of assessing the issue of black box models, the importance of bias, the importance of the quality of inputs. Which brings me back again to the question of intangibles. And I want to drill more into this to understand better how we put value on these intangibles. Because the example you gave us earlier of the salesperson or delivery person who ends the trip close to where their kid is playing soccer, that's great, but it almost sounds like a bonus, like a freebie. If we can do it in a way that also makes them feel good, why not? But the trade-offs imply that you really have to give up something and get something else, and that requires putting a value on some of these intangibles. How do we do it?
Okay, so there's a lot of ways to think about it. And let me just give you an example. So in a situation where you have a service business and the service business is providing a customer service. Let's just say it's something where you have to show up at a certain time and the customer has to be there. What we typically would do is we would create a model where we had all the back office costs in it. You know what the cost per mile is of the vehicles. You know what the cost of labor, you know what overtime costs. You know, all the things that are related to the back office deployment of these, you know, heterogeneous resources that are delivering these services. And then you have the question of getting the right person to the right place at the right time at the right, you know, price and with the right stuff. And so questions like to an operations person, we would ask the question. So what is it worth to be on time versus 30 minutes late? And they would say to us, and we would say, okay, let's try something different. How much deployment costs would you be willing to expend incrementally to be on time versus 30 minutes? And they would say, oh, that's maybe $30. Okay. So, and by the way, in some of these industries, you would have hard penalties like cable. You get a free month's cable. So all those things, you can have combination of customer satisfaction and actual tangible costs, but the intangible is what we're talking about here. And so what we would do then is we'd run a simulation. And this was a really important discovery for us. We came to this epiphany. Operations people couldn't tell you what those values are, but they could tell you when a deployment plan looked good. Like if you put the schedule on a Gantt chart and they saw where everyone is going and they had a little color code so they'd know if the person was late or on time and if it was when their work hours or if they were working overtime. And then they would look at it and they would say, oh, wait, I still got too much late time. And then we'd say, well, in the model, and by the way, the model's obviously got a second order curve. So it's not just fixed 30, but the second order curve then would say, well, what about a $60 for 30 minutes late time? Then we crank it up and all of a sudden they have almost no late time, but then they have overtime. And then these goes, oh, wait. No. I have too much overtime. And so then we dial it back to, say, 45. And he looks at it and he goes, oh, that's great. I mean, I've got a little bit of late time, this is beautiful, okay? But then the power is that, one, the perception by the operations person is at the macro level. They didn't know what the number was. But now, by virtue of having the underlying model, we can go back and look at those trade-offs. Those are the trade-offs. I'm willing to spend $45 more in my cost of deployment to get that person to that location on time versus 30 minutes late. All right. Now, what's also powerful about this is ultimately you could build models that had the amount of time you're late, the likelihood that they churn, the cost of recapturing a customer, all those things could come into those models. But this is the only way we see to be able to tie the front office benefit to the back office cost.
Yes, I guess I want to sort of maybe explore a little bit from a practical standpoint, because I think, you know, this all sounds great, but now I'm trying to imagine I'm a leader in an organization and I'm trying to either start this process or, you know, like what is the trade-off or value optimization? What is the process that I have to go through as a leader to sort of get this work going? You know, what's the level of effort required for me to sort of establish this as a sort of a repeatable framework within my company or my org? What's that process look like?
Well, that's a great question, because what this really is about initially is starting with kind of what we would call what-if analyses, right? It's like, I want to build a model. I want that model to be able to ingest historic data. And then I want to be able to look at how I performed versus how I could have performed. And then by turning those knobs, we're able to show them, like, this is what you did yesterday. This is what you could have done yesterday. And it usually is a combination of both the technologies that optimize systems with changes in the overall process. So, for example, years ago, we had a partnership with GE. We went into a electrical supply and distribution company. They showed us what they had done that day. We then showed them steps of, like, if we optimized your business as the drivers were going out the door, we just gave them a different route. They had to go to the exact same places that they went before. We showed them that they would have gone from driving 1,300 miles to 1,000 miles. And they would have saved about, you know, 8 hours of drive time. This is 12 trucks, by the way. And then we showed them that, if we had run our system the night before and they had loaded the trucks according to the routes that we were going to give them, they would have gone from 1,300 miles to 750. And they would have saved now 16 hours of drive time. And then we showed them that if they just let us optimize the system fully with 9 trucks and 9 drivers, they could do the same amount of work as they did with 12 trucks and 12 drivers, and they would have cut their mileage in half. So very significant. So it's almost like this multi-step process. A little bit of change, more process change, and then full optimization of the system. And it just makes it tangible. They can say, we don't want to have less trucks, or that's fine. But you have a lot of excess capacity that you can go fill up with incremental revenue, incremental delivery.
So there is a little bit of historical data required probably to sort of get the process rolling. And then once you've maybe sort of made that incremental iteration and exploration, you've put a hypothesis out there and you're sort of testing it, hopefully then the new data coming in will help you sort of adjust for whatever the next step is.
And if you have a more complicated, a more nuanced overall operational performance model, like let's say you're in, mobile healthcare business, where customer preferences and provider preferences and, what skills, micro skills they have in terms of phlebotomy or whatever has to be done, well, then it's a much more complicated question. But if so the first thing that we always do is have to understand the data to be able to then build the model, and then the model drives everything. So that is a key piece of what you're asking is, table stakes are you ultimately have to build this kind of overall utility model, and the overall utility model is an extremely powerful tool to help organizations make those inherent trade-offs.
And I wanted to stay on this very pragmatic line of thinking that James puts on. And I'm curious about the impact that you see in organizations when you bring this model into play. One revelation, I assume, will be the fact that as they see, as in the example you just gave us, that if they had used your model yesterday, they would have gotten much better results. They understand, and as you put it earlier, they gain confidence in the model. So the one immediate takeaway will be, actually, this is a fantastic tool. We should be using it. It will give us better performance, better value. But I'm wondering if there is also a second takeaway where they start looking at trade-offs and their own decision-making in a different way, having gotten more guidance and more insights from this exercise.
Well, they do. In fact, we supported everything from union negotiations where there were a whole set of complex union rules that were being negotiated. The union would come and say, we'd like the following. And then we could run simulations and say, if you could get these relaxations around these other things that they generally don't care about, then the offset is essentially, it's neutral. So we would find ways to make concessions be net neutral and allow them to make those trade-offs in even complex legal arrangements. So, generally what we found is not dissimilar from what we found in the space environment, and I want to tie back to space ultimately, that we found a 20% reduction in overall operating costs were generally achievable with the possibility of enabling completely new models and new functions for satellites in that world. And in the commercial markets, we've seen the same. We've seen about a 20% reduction in overall costs. And if you're, if you have $1 billion in costs, that's a couple hundred million dollars a year in savings. And the numbers are very large.
And this is an enormous value, which makes me wonder also that in developing these solutions and these models, which will be different depending on the industry and the context which you apply them, what do you find is the biggest obstacle? What are the biggest difficulties in developing the models and tackling the underlying problems?
Oh, well, typically it's getting the initial buy-in of various decision makers because, we've had people before who I just make decisions based on my gut. And so it's a little bit like Moneyball. So we'd always say, this is Moneyball for operations. And you show up and all the scouts don't like you because they're like, but this is what I do. I bring donuts to the office and I yell at guys. And that's why we did it. And you're going to bring this software and tell me that your software is going to somehow, you know, make that better. And so we've done things like even run challenges. You bring your best scheduler, you bring your best person, and you go against our machine. It's like chess. And we'll see. And we almost always, I mean, it's why we, when we go take these, you know, the data sets, and we begin to run what we call the operational simulation analysis or the strategic opportunity assessment, we're always surprised if there's not 20% improvement. And but you know, by virtue of doing it this way, it just opens up a lot of opportunities. For example, we were in a meeting one time when the COO and the CFO were in there, and we said, look, when we get the model, if you guys will send us, this is to the operations guy, if you send me your compensation plan, we'll set up the software to maximize your, and the CFO complained. And I'm like, well, why are you complaining? Because if he has the right compensation plan, then it should be set up. And actually, think about it. That is, in essence, what this is about. If every component of the overall system is set up to optimize the overall performance, then everybody's aligned. Well, we oftentimes find in these situations where we're, you know, optimizing both internal resources and external resources, and they have service level agreements, is that there's essentially mispricing in those service level agreements, because a penalty into a subcontractor that gets rolled up to the, say, supercontractor is not really aligned. And so that's one of the things that these kinds of models show. They just show misalignment across vast organizations of pricing.
I just want to make one quick comment and then I'll kick it off to James. Sorry, James, but I just wanted to put, because one thing which I think is striking, and I would like it to be very clear to our audience, is we're talking about potential improvements in performance and optimization in the order of sometimes 20%, one of the numbers you mentioned.
Right.
We operate in an economy where we are lucky if productivity grows at 1%. So
right.
Then this gives you a sense of what kind of potential gains we're looking at.
Very significant.
Yeah, and I think when we start talking about sort of to your point, Marco, sort of like changes at sort of economy scale, my mind starts going to sort of the challenges of public policy and specifically sort of those intangibles, the sort of squishy metrics. But when you start talking about intangibles, I think, so, you know, the examples you've talked about, maybe it's a, you know, one intangible being tied back to some sort of dollar on either profit or spending or cost savings. I guess I want to sort of push back a little bit and say, what happens when you start having to deal with multiple intangibles against each other, which maybe don't have a clear tie back to a dollar, or dollars are maybe not the primary consideration of a nonprofit or sort of a government organization? Because I can imagine it being pretty hard to try to draw a line when you're talking about sort of impact or scope of like, what do we consider worth discussing? You know, do we deliver X many more vaccines, but we have to sort of spend much more on transportation? And we're creating, you know, more emissions. Because when you start talking about sort of economic or, you know, national economy scale things,
right,
these are real emissions. These are real challenges.
Right.
And the trade-offs get, I think, a little bit more complex. How do you have those conversations with leaders about scope and impact to sort of keep them grounded to something that is, you know, feasible, but also still fitting to their mission?
Those are great questions. So our general view is that everything is economic. The only question is the currency. And so I'll give you an example. So we were participants in a thing called the COVID-19 Healthcare Coalition. It was facilitated by MITRE and had, you know, 50 global companies on it. And one of the things that came out of that was we used an agent-based model to actually model the spread of COVID on university campuses. And then what we did was we looked at a suite of possible policies in terms of hybrid classrooms, in terms of social distancing, in terms of masking, in terms of testing, and looked at, using the agent-based model, how those would actually propagate out to drive a set of health metrics, and looked at which of those, you know, how you might then tie things like not having gatherings, not having in-person class, how that would change the experience of the students, and how to kind of maximize the student experience whilst at the same time minimizing the spread of COVID. So none of those are economic in the way that we think of it. Like, we were just talking about potentially, you know, students, although I'm sure it would be tied ultimately to students choosing to stay in school the following semester. You know, the main goal of the school's many were try to get the students back in the winter semester. But they were the changed environment, they were just trying to make sure they could get them back. But we looked at those trade-offs and, you know, which of these policies are actually going to be effective and use modeling and simulation to decide it. And again, it was all just trade-offs of policies of closing the gym or not having gatherings or not having or having hybrid classes and how those. But the currency was just a different currency. One thing I would bring out in terms of just this mindset of thinking about trade-offs, though, we had in that same coalition, we had people from Mayo and other places that were just making comments about, hey, we're here to save lives. And my response to that was, well, I think what we're actually talking about is the trading of lives. And it did turn out, you know, post-COVID, they found that there were 70 plus thousand incremental malaria deaths because people were not either willing or able to avail themselves of other healthcare. And so all these decisions, we just have to understand, are extremely complex and in some ways chaotic systems that if you make a little change someplace, you can't predict without what things might grow without bound. And I think that's one of the great things of this trade-off framework is that you begin to understand or think about things not as a single thing you're trying to accomplish, but actually as a set of compromises that have to be made in order to get the best outcome.
It's a fantastic point. I think it actually brings us to a very good point to start wrapping up our discussion and to start taking stock of what I think are the takeaways that we can bring back from this fascinating discussion. For me, the biggest takeaway is the following. It sounds like this values-based optimization and its models does two things. One is it brings greater clarity to decision makers across organizations, whether it's in corporations, in science, universities, in policymaking circles. It just clarifies the mind on what are all the factors at play and how to trade them off against each other. The other thing it does is it teaches you the value of a tool. It teaches you that when the optimization is so complex with so many moving parts, you do need a very complex model to do the optimization in a dynamic way for you, because otherwise you'll never be able to squeeze out all the value that you could. So that to me is the biggest takeaway. What about you, James?
Yeah, I really like the last things you said, Ed, about sort of it's all economics. The question is the currency. I think that's a really sort of good way to think about it, because I think you sort of put that in the context of one of your earlier answers. I really like that idea of the modifying the driving routes to sort of increase employee satisfaction. So there are these probably, you know, incredible win-win opportunities that a lot of sectors and industries out there for value-based optimization could sort of, you know, illuminate. What is required is that the leaders have to maybe reframe the metrics to include these sorts of values in their optimization. Again, so they have to choose the right currency to sort of get at what they really want. And I think that's the thing that's probably going to ring in my mind for a while now.
And there's a lot more that we could discuss, and we could go on and on with equally fascinating points. But before we wrap up, Ed, what about you? What would you like our audience to take away from this discussion?
I think in the world we live in, seeing the fact that everything is a trade-off helps us to think about how we compromise, how we can come to joint solutions. In the words of the great Howard Baker, the reason I listen to other people is because they might be right. And so we listen and we think about those trade-offs and we think about how to make as many intangibles tangible. How do we decide what is this worth and how do we want to make those trade-offs and do it explicitly? Because I just think that's the way we'll ultimately get to the best solutions.
Ed, thanks very much. Thanks for being with us today. This has been a fantastic discussion. Thanks, James, for sharing the burden. And thanks to all of our audience. And please do join us for future episodes that will explore technological advances and structural patterns that will help us to better innovate, operate, and navigate in this increasingly connected world. Please subscribe to the podcast, share it, and you can learn more about it and about our work at shoshinworks.com. Thanks again so much, and we'll see you in the next episode.